Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. So, yesterday we had a nice day sit. Many of you were here for that. A lot of people. And Jeff Kelly talked about the whole world is alive. This is the wisdom month, this month. And that is a wisdom that Zen can help us discover, that the whole world is alive, that it's that my world is not just my little personal world of struggle, but that there is another world out there waiting for us that is alive, if we can find it, that's always there. And that is a kind of wisdom. It's not enough just to say that. It's not enough just to say, the whole world is alive, go find it. That's a part of it. But it really has to be a bodily wisdom that we develop. The feeling that the whole world is alive. It's a feeling. It has to be a feeling, not a thought. I mean, maybe a thought too, to begin with. But it has to be a feeling. That's what he talked about, despair. About the despair that we can feel now and then when our vision narrows. And the whole neighborhood is alive with clucking. So I want to talk about bodily wisdom today, but a different spin on it. I've been thinking about what it is to greet and see and relate to another. So, in a way, yesterday's talk was about kind of how we relate to the world, the whole world. I want to narrow that down to another person in particular. I've been thinking about that otherness. I mean, I often do. So I'll say a few things about that today. First thing to say is that our practice starts with ourselves. And so when considering the other, Buddhism tends to start with considering yourself. It's not going to end there, but it starts with that. So, Miranda? Is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you might be the only one that haven't heard this. But so this guy walks into the doctor, you know? And he says, Doc, I don't know what's the matter with me. I touch myself here, I hurt. I touch myself here, I hurt. I touch myself here, I hurt. And the doctor says, Sir, I think you have a broken finger. I heard that on the Prairie Home Companion joke show many, many years ago, and it just doesn't get old for me. It's a Buddhist joke. It's the point is that the trouble is, the primary trouble is not out there. The primary trouble is with yourself. The primary trouble is with your pointing finger. And that is a kind of a deep truth that Buddhism really holds, that we have to look at ourselves first. And And the primary practice that we do, like Dogen said, to study Zen is to study the self. Look at yourself. And then he said, the next weird thing he said was, to to study yourself is to lose yourself. So that, and that is the primary practice that we use. We study ourselves, we end actually end the world by losing ourselves. But that's the, that's what we did this morning. We just sat here quietly and did our best to lose our concerns. And when we do that, when we do that to the extent that we do it well, it doesn't have to be perfect, we get more calm, less turbulence, and then the next step is not just calm. Jim mentioned calm yesterday, kind of calm and attentive. I often use those two words together. But it's not just calm, it's also non-discriminatory. This is harder. That's harder, that part, the not discriminating. So when you're sitting, I mean, just now, Sissel closed the door because the chickens. That's discrimination against the chickens. But that's okay, because if we're giving a talk, we're sort of not in deep zazen right now. But if we were, when we are, and the chickens erupt, that's what's happening. And it's really our job to not discriminate between the chickens and the sweet little birds that the chickens are drowning out. Or the cars and all of that. That it's that's a harder practice, but it's an essential one. It's an essential one, and it's actually essential for that reason that things like chickens happen, and difficulty, and that's another talk altogether. But we get stretched, that we have bad zazen because of it. That's an essential part. But if we can find that non-discrimination, or finding that non-discriminating mind, is an important part of our path. And what I went downstairs to find was, I knew I had, this is a very important quote here that I have no idea where it is in my notes. So, well, I'll just paraphrase it. It's the third ancestor. It's Sen San's Believing in Mind poem, which we read last fall. The great way is not hard. Just give up choosing. Just give up picking and choosing. And just give up give up wanting this or that. And that is that's a real song, the whole thing, to non-discriminating thought. And Jonathan Haidt, who wrote a book called The Righteous Mind, that I read so that I could give a talk on in Norway on tribalism, uses that exact quote in his book, like at the very end of his introduction, uses that same quote from Sen San. And I just thought, wow. Okay, so that piqued my interest, of course. And he says, if we can understand that mind, then if we want to understand ourselves and our divisions and the roots of our self-righteousness about our position, then we need to be able to step back into something like that, some kind of non-discriminating mind. But then he says, on the other hand, I don't know if I'd want to live that way, he says. You know, and that's a common problem with Zen. Well, we're not asking you to live that way all the time, but we're asking you to understand that mind deeply, to really temporarily immerse yourself in that mind and see how that changes your point of view when you come back to yourself. Yeah, I was always taught the state of not picking and choosing is temporary. You can't be permanent. You cannot stay in heaven. You know, as my teacher said, there's no restaurants or bathrooms there. And after becoming quiet, inevitably the self comes back and reappears, and you have to choose again, you know, between the hardware store or Mace or wherever. But yourself is different for knowing that place. And I think if it's done, if that practice is done in the context of a healthy community and of teaching, I think it leads to a more open-minded attitude and away from a kind of hardened, fixated, sometimes self-righteous point of view. I think this feeling of non-discrimination, knowing the place of non-discrimination, coming back from the place of non-discrimination, knowing that that exists, helps us approach other people. But we have to feel it. It can't just be something we say. You know, I'm not going to discriminate. I don't think it's enough to say it. I think it's something we have to feel viscerally, bodily. So that, you know, when we see somebody who's from a different group, for instance, somebody we don't like, or somebody we've made up our minds about, that we feel something slightly different. Because it's the feeling that leads. When we see somebody else, especially from a different group, it's the feeling that leads and tends to blind us to other aspects of that person. So Haidt says that we often mistake this, but it's intuitions that come first and rationale later. Intuitions about somebody. And then we lay a rationale on top of that. I mean, yeah. I find the World Cup happened today. I already know France won. I'll just tell you. Yeah, France won 4-2. I just kind of decided that Croatia beat England, so I was pulling for France. But once you decide something, like once you decide one side's better than the other side, you find all kinds of reasons to like that side and all kinds of reasons not to like the other side. It's just true. It's happened so many times for me. I won't even go into all the reasons that I like those two. Take it from me, though. And Haidt says, it's like we're a little rider. I like this image a lot. It's like our intellect is a little rider on top of a large elephant. And the rider is our conscious reasoning self, and the elephant is the rest of our mental processes, you know, underneath that. And the rider, you know, feels like he's in control, but if the elephant decides he's going to go one way or another, it's going to go that way. So the driver can't just decide to be more open, that this is his point, and I agree with it. And that's why we practice, to open our bodies, to open our intuitions, to question them and to open them. To work with our elephant, to make our elephant more calm. And I think this practice can help us tame our elephant. Thich Nhat Hanh has a beautiful story about, you know, we read it on Wednesday night not too long ago, where the devil, Mara, comes visiting to the Buddha. Remember that? Was anybody here on that Wednesday night? No, nobody. Okay, well, you know, maybe you were. Okay, I'll tell you more. It's in his commentary on the Heart Sutra, which is really, I really like a lot.
Yeah, not recent Wednesday night.
Right, it's true. So the Buddha's attendant, Ananda, answers the door and tells him to get lost. Hello. But the Buddha asks from the other room, who's that? So Ananda tries to tell him it's nobody, and then the Buddha figures out who it is, and he says, oh, come on in for tea. And I can't find this story anywhere else, by the way. I don't know if Thich Nhat Hanh made it up or not. But so they sit down for tea, and Mara starts complaining. And he says, you know, it's hard to be me. It's hard to be Mara. He says, you know, I've got to talk in riddles all day. I've got a lot of pressure to kind of be evil all the time. And my disciples, they're all kinds of troubles. They're interested in nonviolence now. And maybe you should take them all, tells the Buddha. And the Buddha says, oh, geez, no, thank you. It's no picnic for me either. You know? Like, my disciples are quarreling with each other and talking about where to build one of these stupid stupas and that I don't even want. They don't listen to me. So it turns out that they have a lot in common, the Buddha and Mara. But they never would have figured that out if they hadn't sat down together. And they wouldn't have if Ananda had gotten his way. I think we all have an Ananda, you see. We have all this, have this Ananda that's like, yeah, no, uh-uh. No, don't stay out. Don't let that dude in. But, yeah. So I think we have to practice this non-discrimination, you see, not only on the cushion, but also we have to make it a practice in our lives. We have to take those steps. We have to actively take those steps. That's part of our Zen practice, people. It's not just about sitting here and feeling calm and good and feeling like the whole world is alive. We got to go out there and test it. And that's not always easy. You know, my wife and I have a meditation supply business. That's my day job. And so a few years ago, we decided we were going to hire somebody. You know, we'd had a few employees before. We decided, we chose Mary, not her real name. She was interested in the job. She seemed quick. And then after she'd been on the job for about a couple of days only, I said, you know, part of the job, if you'd like, we meditate every, you know, on the clock. We have a sitting. And she said, oh, no, thanks. I won't be doing that. I'm a member of the church next door, the evangelical church next door. I face planted. And I told Lidu, and I said, this is just not, I'm telling you, this is not going to work out. There's been a mistake. handling all those Buddha statues and answering the phone and memorizing all the weird Japanese names. I told Lidu, and I grew up with people, you know, in the South like this, evangelicals. Trust me. Lidun said, well, you know, it's funny because it doesn't look that way to me. It seems like she's into the job and she chose this job. And I realized, wow, I'm the bigot here. I'm the bigot here. And I thought those guys were supposed to be the bigots. And, of course, of the numbers of employees we had, she was the best one we had. She was fantastic all the way through, and we're still friends. You know, they moved off island. They moved to Korea. We still keep in touch by Facebook. It's not always easy. We have these prejudices. We have these ways of seeing the world, and we have to work to see past them in some way. That is part of our practice, I think. And since then, I'm happy to say, I've become friends with the minister next door, Mike. Really, really friends with him. He and I have coffee. We don't agree. I mean, we don't talk theology much. I'm sure we would not agree on a lot of those points. But I learn a lot from him, and he from me, I think, about many of the common points. We have many common points that if you just looked at us on paper, you would not guess. I mean, not only that we're both fathers and this, that, and the other, but many of the ways a church works, many of the ways young people are these days, etc., etc. Yeah. And so, I think that's, I really appreciate the contact I have with other ministers from other traditions. And that's been something, it's only been 5 or 6 years that I've kind of leaned into that. But I've learned a lot about my own assumptions since doing that interfaith work. You know, yeah, I really enjoy the Mormons, for instance. Jim Kapansky, who used to lead the Mormon Church, I just see him on the ferry, not infrequently or somewhere. He is always remembers my name, always uses it, always asking me how's business. He owns Bassett Furniture, and you know. So, in the Zen school, I think we should be good at this. I think Zen has a kind of modesty about itself that's worth remembering. We have this direction not to hold on too tightly to the sacred, to our sacred values, our sacredness. You know, kill when you see the Buddha on the road, kill him. And Zen is a finger pointing at the moon. When you find the moon, you don't need the finger anymore. And there are also Zen themes that celebrate the other, the outsider. Bodhidharma was an outsider. Hui Ning was a little squirt, you know, who didn't know anything, illiterate, who became, who turned out was the smartest of all the monks, even though he wasn't even a monk. And the celebrated poet Ikkyu, you know, who was invited to a patron's dinner and shows up in a beggar's robe, in his regular beggar's robe, and he's turned away at the door, and then he comes back in his fancies and oh, come on in. And then he, you know, finds a seat, folds up his robe, puts it on his seat, says, thank you very much for the invitation, but since it seems you invited these robes to dinner, I'll leave these here and I'll go. It's the same message, you know. It's don't let appearances fool you. They're not... and the outsider, the other, may be more than you think, maybe more than you assume. So I want to ask you to go out and meet people different from you. Don't fall into the, you know, into thinking that this practice is only to get calm and to feel better. It is that, I think. But it's more than that, too. It's pushing yourself out and testing yourself and opening yourself to new experiences. I've just talked about kind of the other vaguely, you know, the other group, member of another group. This is also true, by the way, of people that we're in relationships with. You know, people that we've decided, oh, this person is like this. And, or, you know, long-term related, spouses, kids, parents. Sometimes that whole finger joke is true too, that if I shift something, if I try to look at somebody differently that I've known for a long time, that something in that mix changes and that person appears to be more than they are, than I've assumed they are. Zen Master Rinzai from the 8th century says, from which this, you know, school grew. One of his most commonly used words is enter. This is Rinzai Zen. Don't just sit there. Enter. Enter the land of the Buddha land. Enter the land of sorrow. Enter all the different Buddha lands. Walk through hell as if it's a pleasure garden, he says. Enter hell. Walk, keep walking. And we have to learn from the situations and people that we meet while walking. It's part of our practice. So please do that. Please, when you leave here, enter different worlds, find different people, and do your best to open to them.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.